Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hey, and welcome back. My name is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. I've got a kick-ass guest for you guys this week. His name is JP Sears. He's a YouTube superstar, an author, a holistic coach, and an awesome guy all the way around. I first discovered JP through his YouTube channel. He's got some really, really popular videos that some of you might have heard, such as If Meat Eaters Acted Like Vegans and How to Become Gluten Intolerant. Both of those have over 8 million views on YouTube each. This past a few months ago, I saw him MC at an event that showed me a new side of him. And that's what inspired me to get him on the podcast, because I saw a side of him that was very thoughtful and really inspiring. And so in this show, we talk about the importance of being authentic. The most common ways that people, you know, including us, are inauthentic, and how to be more yourself, how to be more authentic, how to let more of yourself shine through. We talk about how to stop having negative emotions, how to reframe being outside your comfort zone, how to put it in a way that seems more powerful and more attractive. And then finally, how to reinvigorate your life or invigorate it for the first time. Before we get started, if you haven't done so already, please head to iTunes, hit the subscribe button, and leave me a review. Enjoy the show. JP, thanks for joining me, brother. I really appreciate your time today.
For sure, Michael. I'm pleased as a peach to be here. Just to start things off with a cheesy, stupid saying. Pleased as a peach. I think I hate myself now.
You never
said
that.
Why did I say that?
So as I was telling you before we started, my wife and I saw you speak at the Genius Network annual event, and I really got to see another side of you. I've been watching your videos for the past couple years, have enjoyed a lot of laughs over it, because some of the topics are like, they're making fun of me, you know? And sure. So I've been able to find
all of my videos are about you, Mike.
Yeah, exactly.
Stop beating around the bush.
So I've you know, gotten to see a little bit of myself, find a little humor in the things that I do, and get kind of the underlying message in some of those videos. And then through this MC event, I got to see yet another side of you that's even more thoughtful and another level of depth. And that's what inspired me to reach out to you and schedule this podcast. So I'm really excited to see where it goes. So yeah. As all podcasts should go, I think we should start with enlightenment. Do you remember the exact moment where you became enlightened?
Yeah, it was 3:33 a.m. this morning, which is that's a very sacred time because there's three threes. So it's a holy trinity, and it's a holy trinity of trinities. And 3 + 3 + 3 = 9, which is somehow there's a lot of dogma about how that's an awesome number. And up until 3:33 a.m. this morning, I had been faking it, and now it's for real. And I think the universe, or whoever's up there or down there or all around or inside, they really wanted to up-level me to be ready for the conversation with you, Michael.
I really appreciate that. So at this event that we were both at that you emceed, you spent most of the time just fucking with the various speakers, but there was also interwoven in the whole show was your personal story. So, which I found really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about your path from your path into guruhood? So where were you, you know, in your late teens, your early 20s? What was kind of the defining period for you, and really what changed?
Yeah, you know, I think there were a couple defining moments, if you will, or dare I say, rites of passage that were longer than a moment, but still like a real definitive look back, like that was meaningful. So when I was 18, I dropped out of college after 3 months because I obviously was just done with college, which either means I wasn't smart enough for it or too smart for it, probably both. And I started studying a guy's stuff named Paul Check. Have you ever heard of him?
Yep.
So got into his work, which at the time it was predominantly exercise and nutrition related. And then shortly thereafter started taking, well, I took my first in-person class with him. And here's the a defining moment. During that first class with him, you know, I rock up. I'm the youngest kid in the class by far, the least experienced by far, but I was prepared as hell. And that really caught his attention. And by the end of that class, he looked at me and said, JP, one day you're going to be working with me at the Czech Institute, teaching my classes, and the world's going to know you. It's just like really cool. And I didn't believe him, mm-hmm. but I definitely believe that he believed what he was saying. And so he saw something in me, and seeing the way he believed in me help trigger something inside of me to start believing in myself to a much greater degree than I had before. So that was a very pivotal moment for me. And fast forward a few years into my early 20s, I think it was 23, when I did move out to the Czech Institute and start teaching Paul's courses with him. So, and that set off the whole trajectory of getting really immersed in his exercise stuff, then his nutrition stuff. And then that got me interested in like, wow, the mind and the heart, the psyche, that's an amazing place that can really impact a person's life for the better or worse, just depending on how neglected or addressed it is. So that got me interested in doing my coaching practice predominantly at an emotional healing coaching level, which that's what I've been rolling with for the past 16 or 17 mm-hmm. years now.
Love it, man. So at some point you made this transition into using humor to teach. How did that happen?
Well, there's two phases of it. It'd be too straightforward if I gave you just one answer, Michael. So I'll give you two just to be difficult. The first part of that was in 2006, I started teaching classes for the Czech Institute, these 3-day long holistic lifestyle coaching courses filled with great information, but boring as hell, like super useful. But like, I'm bored after 11 minutes of listening to something. Right. And these were like 3 full days of just pure lecture class. So I don't want to bore people, and I don't want to bore myself. So I just sort of intuitively, I started like doing this dance with the classes where we're on these 3-day immersions with each other. And I was finding if I could make them laugh, you know, not 24/7, but somewhat frequently, I had a much better time. And I think their learning experience was better. I think we all learn better when we're in an emotionally heightened state. Mm-hmm. So, but I would be very dry with them. A lot of my jokes, they wouldn't be obvious. It would typically take a class about a half a day to figure me out, where I would say something just completely ridiculous sandwiched between a couple like legit insightful pieces right. of information. And I'd have the same straight face on, and I'd watch the classes be divided into three parts, where part of the class would laugh. The other third of the class would just like look at me in horror, like, Why would he say that? And then the other third of the class would just be confused. But after lunch on the first day, everybody kind of got on board, like, all right, this guy's just a little weird, has a sense of humor. So that got me, I mean, literally over the years, thousands of hours of experience working with an audience on meaningful topics, but making them laugh along the way. Then the second part of the answer is on October 5th, 2014, I released my first YouTube comedy video. I'd been doing sincere life advice videos for about a year and a half before that, but finally I let my sense of humor out on video. I thought it'd be bad.
What was that first one?
It was called How to Be Ultra Spiritual.
Yeah.
And like, I still, man, this is going to be bad for business, but how can I not do it? I want to do this. And I've been trying to, I've been wanting to not want to do it, but I just gotta. So I did. And it turns out I was dead wrong. It was the best thing I ever did for business. So all, you know, all that class time from 2006 to 2013, and then the first comedy YouTube video in 2014 were really key pivotal moments, is a new word instead of pivotal. And, you know, I don't know, I maybe I should blame it on like astrology, like, you know, Mercury was in retrograde and Jupiter's third moon's anus was in retrograde. So that's why those two events happened. But those two events really triggered a hell of a lot of blessings coming my way in terms of personal satisfaction and awesome opportunities that have opened up for me.
That's so cool, man. What's been your, I don't know, most fulfilling, what's been the funnest video for you to make?
I could give you 10 different answers, but the first one that comes to my mind is one I did almost a year ago called Passive Aggressive Relationship Techniques. Mm-hmm. And that was not the first, but one of the first videos that my fiance Amber was in.
Nice.
And, you know, that was so fun because we were doing something new together. She felt intimidated about being in a video of mine, but I love her courage where she's like, yeah, let's do this anyway. And I love just her laughing at me all the time, just so codependently, emotionally validates me. So she was just cracking up all the time, had to do a bunch of retakes, but I'll never forget, we're just sitting on the couch that used to be there in my living room that I'm pointing to now that I'm moving out of tomorrow. So it was a very fond memory for sure.
That's awesome, man. So going back to the event that we were both at, you ended it. Somebody asked you to just kind of close it out, and you ended it with by far the most like profound thing that was said at this whole event. And you said, if I were pretending to know what life is all about, it'd be something like, be your fucking self. And so it seems like your videos, your book, et cetera, are a way to find, to help people find where they're being inauthentic in their lives without being shaming, without being shaming, right? Being very lighthearted and allowing people to find that in an almost effortless way. So how do you define being yourself?
Man, that's, I don't know that I have a good definition.
What is inauthenticity?
Yeah, I think inauthenticity, you're right, I think that's much easier to define, but I think inauthenticity is when we think we're something we're not. And usually that comes down to, we become very self-identified with our beliefs, and instead of having beliefs and then being willing to compost those beliefs, upgrade them, outgrow them, we get into a place of, the more we start to self-identify with our beliefs, that means we're believing our beliefs instead of just having beliefs. And I think that limits us. I think a good belief will serve us for a little bit of time, but I think all people just naturally want to grow, which means who we really are is bigger than our beliefs. Mm-hmm. But if we stay attached to a belief, man, that means we're playing it small. So I think who we are, who we really are, is largely a mystery. So I think who we are, being authentic, it's a forever in the moment discovery. And a lot of it has to do with figuring out who we're not and not being it. And I there's a note I had written on my desk that's no longer where my desk used to be moving. But the note, and it's been on my desk for at least 6 years, it says, what wants to live through me? And I think being authentic is, we're sort of like in service to, I don't know if it's our higher self or more practically called our purpose. I think there's something that wants to live through each of us. And when we're true to that, we're being authentic. But when we aren't true to that, maybe because we're afraid, we don't know if things are going to work out. We're afraid to take the call to adventure and the hero's journey that is our own life. then that means we're not being authentic mm-hmm. with what wants to live through us. We're not being in service to our purpose. We choose a life of safety, maybe living in the coffin of our comfort zone, which I think is very synonymous with inauthenticity. Yeah, I love it too. It's just kind of a little shock value. But I think I lost my train of thought.
I fucked that up.
It is your fault, but Michael, welcome to your podcast. You're allowed to. What I was going to say, I think one of the most deadly pesticides against authenticity is when we're trying to value ourselves through the currency of approval. When we are engineering our thoughts, our actions, our choices for approval, that is absolutely us putting DDT on our authenticity. Mm-hmm. I think our authenticity is not always, but most of the time, very different than what's going to get us approval.
Right. So you're a teacher and you've worked with, I'm assuming, thousands of individuals over the years. What are some of the most common ways you see people hiding themselves and being inauthentic?
Well, I think a super common way is people getting their emotional needs met through self-sabotage. It's like self-sabotage, whether that's sabotaging relationships, sabotaging happiness, sabotaging finances, sabotaging their health, sabotaging their fitness, procrastination. Self-sabotage comes in many forms. It is a way that will get people's emotional needs met easily. Mm-hmm. Not ideally, not in a way that's engineered to make someone thrive, but in a way that it'll give them a sense of significance, a sense of predictability, a sense of comfort, a sense of certainty, which are in a sense of connection. Albeit all crappy forms of it, but nonetheless, it can be a path of least resistance. So I think people really can keep themselves in a very small box of inauthenticity when they're getting their emotional needs met the easy way, which is also usually a way that involves a fair bit of pain, through self-sabotage.
So I think a lot of people listening to this can immediately think of someone in their life that is being inauthentic, right? Because we're so good at seeing it in others. And a lot of times we're not so good at seeing it in ourselves. Because one of the things that really plagues people are the things that they don't know, right? They're just unaware of it completely. What are some ways that people can identify that they're being inauthentic? Is there a feeling or kind of a way of being that can kind of clue them in that they're being inauthentic in an area of their life?
Well, I think so. It's subtle, but it's definitely there. So it's worth looking for. And just a little bit of a preamble to my delusional thought that'll spring out about that is, I think first off, I think it was Ram Dass who once said, you can't get out of a jail you don't know you're in. Mm-hmm. You can't outgrow ways you're being inauthentic until you realize you're inauthentic. So I think all of us, and I mean all of us, the ones named JP in this conversation, Michael, and everybody else involved, we don't need to ask ourselves, am I being inauthentic? It's like, it's not if I'm doing it, but how am I doing it kind of question.
Gotcha.
It's part of human nature. So I think that's an assumption we can all make. Just have a little teaspoon of humbleness so we can realize, yeah, I too am a human.
And right.
So, but I think we all live in miraculous biofeedback instruments called our bodies. They speak a very sophisticated language. It is a much wiser form of language than English or thought. So it can sometimes be hard to understand the wisdom that our biofeedback machines give us because it's very wise. So I think the wise language that shows up when we're being inauthentic, that tells us we're being inauthentic, how it registers for me is like, I'll get like a heaviness in my gut and in my chest. And granted, it doesn't weigh 90 pounds. It's subtle. It's like a 3-ounce compression of heaviness. Mm-hmm. And often, like if I make a decision or a commitment that's geared around like approval or like I think who I'm supposed to be is someone doing this, there will also be the void of excitement. It'll kind of be, for me, empty and heavy. And then the inverse is true for me. And this might show up different for different people, but I think there's some commonalities here. But when we're being true to what's authentic to us in the moment, the opposite happens. I feel lighter. I feel a sense of excitement. There's oftentimes fear as well, but simultaneously excitement and a sense of levity. And I would dare say a more general sense of like, I feel better living in my own skin.
Right.
Whereas when we're being inauthentic, that is us betraying ourselves. And we all know, like, if you're living with someone who cheats you, say you're sharing an apartment with them, like, it's going to feel crappy living with them. But what if that person's yourself? You're living in your own skin. It's hard to live with. So there's that kind of ickiness, like, man, I'm the creepy guy that's betraying myself. So we got to live with that when we're being inauthentic. And that's kind of a little abstract way I think the biofeedback shows up for us.
Yeah, I like that. I would add to that, that it's really exhausting. You know, when I'm being authentic and I really feel like I'm acting in the way that I value, acting in alignment with my values, I feel kind of energized by the way I'm living. But if I'm not doing that, if I'm making decisions not in line with my values, I feel really exhausted, and not physically, but on a deeper level. And it'll manifest as depression sometimes, or a lot of stress and anxiety. And it just really, really wears on me when I'm doing things in line with my values. I'm really doing, you know, being myself. I feel energized. I feel, like you said, I feel a lot of fear a lot of times because I'm pushing myself outside of my comfort zone, but it pushes me further than I could have gone before.
100%. I think that's incredibly wise. And the same is true for me too. I love that. I will also say, before we make this sound too easy and glorious, I think what's authentic for us today will hopefully not be authentic for us a year from now. It's just like when you're 10, what's authentic to you is a fourth grade education. Like, that serves you well. That's right where you're at. But if you're like, wow, fourth grade, that's authentic to me. Like, I feel energized and everything. Well, if you stay attached to that out of the belief of like that, that's authentic to me, and there's sort of like a forever implication on that indictment, then 10 years later, you're 20 years old in fourth grade. What once upon a time energized you and felt good is probably de-energizing you. I mean, you're not growing if you've been in fourth grade for 10 years. So I think we have to be very intentful to check in, like in this moment, like you make a decision, I'm going to do this, and it enlivens you now. Awesome. But also feel for when it stops enlivening you. I think it's just like supplements. Sometimes a supplement, it's going to work really good for you now. And then in 6 months, maybe your chemistry is balanced. And if you keep taking that supplement, it'll push you too far in the other direction. So I think authenticity is a verb. It's a journey. It's not a destination.
And it kind of goes back to what you started by saying, but you have to be willing to let go of beliefs over and over and over. And it takes a level of vulnerability to say, what I really strongly, firmly believed for so long and felt was authentic is no longer authentic for me. And you shed saying, I don't know, I don't really know the new way, but I know that's not me anymore. That's not authentic anymore. And that's a scary place to be.
Yeah, it's like there's a paradox. In order to be true to ourselves, we have to be willing to betray our past self. You know, when you're turning 11, you got to betray your 10-year-old self. Like, okay, fourth grade, not for me anymore. You know, there's some big ones that are easy for us. We realize, like, believing in Santa Claus, Okay, that's painful, but we all do a good job of outgrowing that belief. But there's so many others. I mean, thousands, if not millions of other beliefs that we are bigger than now. But part of us is still unconsciously attached to them. They might be family values. They might be nutritional dogmas that were right for us in a certain time, but now we've outgrown them. They might be life philosophies. Man, I think belief in ourself, like that's a huge spectrum. So many of us are way more powerful than we think we are. I'm not talking about ego power. I'm talking about like real, legit power, bringing gifts of contribution to the world to help better people's lives and help better our life. But when we're not willing to believe in ourselves because we're stuck in a story of limitation, like, yeah, you know, I've got shame from the past or I failed in the past. And yeah, we did. But those experiences were meant to make us grow, not define us. Mm-hmm. But when we're stuck still believing those beliefs of ourself, it's like, wow, my lack of belief in myself, that's kindergarten. And I got to let myself outgrow kindergarten because like now I'm, you know, we're not even a PhD. We're the wise man or woman with a white beard sitting on top of the mountain.
Right. I love it.
Men and women have the beard in this analogy.
Everybody has beards at that level.
We don't want to offend anybody. Sure. Yeah, just so many hormonal issues. The women have beards. Like, what up?
Enjoying this episode? Hit subscribe. We have more amazing content for you every single week.
This episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. ButcherBox is an online meat subscription service that sends you some of the best meat on the planet right to your doorstep. I made a decision this year to start choosing quality over quantity, and that's in terms of movement, in terms of relationships, and in terms of food. I know that I'm going to eat meat every single day, so I made the decision to start using ButcherBox myself because they send you the highest quality meat you can possibly find. It's all 100% grass raised and finished meat. They're pasture raised animals as well as antibiotic free. Here are some of the benefits that you get from eating grass fed meat. So first off, it has higher levels of vitamins. There's more protein per ounce than in conventional meat. And some of the biggest ones are that it reduces cellular inflammation and improves brain function, and then it helps you get nutrients into your cells better. It also increases something called CLA. Increased CLA is going to improve your metabolism, making it easier for you to burn fat, improve your blood sugar levels. It helps you to fight cancer and reduces your risk of heart disease. The biggest reason that I got it is because it's some of the tastiest meat I've ever had, and I know that it's going to keep me healthier for longer. If you're interested, you can head to butcherbox.com/brute for a free package of bacon plus $20 off of your first order. All right, I want to jump into a couple topics of your book and kind of out myself. I found I found a couple chapters that really spoke to me especially. So one of them was a chapter about emotions, and you said the best way to overcome negative emotions is just not to have them. And I laughed. I love that. And it made me think of this weekend that I had when I had known my now wife for about 6 months. And we stayed with some people, and the guy that we stayed with, he was hitting on my wife really hard right in front of me, and she didn't stop him. And what came up for me was an intense amount of jealousy and envy, or I guess just pure jealousy. And what I want to ask you about is this, what happened to me is I tried to push the jealousy away so much because I feel that, and I've thought this for so long, it's been ingrained in me that jealousy is like a nasty emotion and I should never feel it. And it means that I'm like selfish and just low. It means I'm really low. And so I didn't honor that emotion at all. I just tried to push it away, but I also distanced myself from my wife and this guy that was hitting on her. And I had an absolutely terrible weekend, man. just an awful weekend because I didn't talk to her about it. I just kept it to myself and tried to, again, push that emotion away. And I think that's really common. Like, we all have our emotions that we don't allow ourselves to really feel, and it doesn't turn out well. So why do we do this with emotions, and what's a better, like, what's a higher level response?
Yeah. So I think what I heard you describe is what we would call denial. I think denial is the easy way. And I think, like so many other things in life, the easy way makes life easier short term, whether that's 1 minute, an hour, or a weekend. But it's short term easy at the expense of ourselves, at the expense of long term happiness. So I think we do that because it's easy. It doesn't take vulnerability. It takes just the turtle going in its shell, denial. We'll pretend it's not there. Denial or jealousy. I'll just constipate that. So what we have to think about is, imagine you ate food. It's like, well, you know, that food, it might have been crappy food, like jealousy. None of us are proud when we're jealous, even though it's a natural human emotion. So imagine you ate a meal of crappy food and you're like, that was so crappy. I'm not going to ever have a bowel movement because I don't want to experience this food again. So we just constipate ourselves. And I mean, we all know if you constipate yourself, you can become very toxic. Yeah, it's crappy to let out, but it's good for us to let out. So I think emotions are the same way. When we go into denial, pretend they're not there, it doesn't make them go away. It just means we constipate them emotionally. And that makes us, they start to dominate us. Much like you mentioned, you know, your weekend became dominated through disconnection from your wife, the other guy, and the whole situation. So I think why we do that in just a soundbite is, we have an emotional charge about our emotions. So when we have an emotional charge, like let's say we have shame about jealousy, that emotional charge about the emotional charge makes it feel like this isn't okay to have. So let me just pretend I don't have it. But if we can not react and create an emotional charge about the emotional charge, but better said, respond. And we can only respond if we are granting ourselves permission to be vulnerable. And we say to ourselves, like, look, I'm not going to appear to be a real man as defined by society, maybe my father, maybe some of my friends. Instead of that, I'm going to be real. Mm-hmm. If I have an emotion, I'm going to be honest with it. It takes way more courage. The real man or woman is the one when they feel jealous. Instead of being afraid to feel jealousy and being dishonest with it, they'll say it. And that's what allows us to have the bowel movement to poop it out and go beyond it. Otherwise, it's in us.
Yep.
And feeling is the evidence of healing. None of us are proud when we're angry, jealous, sad. But those are very real human emotions. And I don't think those emotions, though a lot of us have a sense of shame about them, an emotional charge about the emotional charge. I don't think anybody has ever been hurt by those uncomfortable emotions. I think we hurt ourselves trying to avoid them. Right. And just like you, Michael, I've disconnected from people in my life, not intending to, but I'm trying to disconnect from an emotion that I don't want to communicate. But really, that hurts all of us, because we disconnect from the person that emotion's associated with. And I think we all deserve better than that. But it takes a lot of courage to be honest with an emotion. It does.
That's been one of the most powerful reframes in my entire life that I've made. Is I grew up thinking that sharing that type of thing, sharing fear or jealousy or envy, was an act of weakness. Feeling it in the first place is an act of weakness. Telling other people lets them know I'm weak, right?
Yeah.
The reframe is that what you're saying is that the people that can share it and just be themselves and honor their own emotions are the courageous ones. And I almost look at it like those are the warriors, the people that can share over and over and over and just be authentic are the absolute warriors.
I agree. And to me, the illusion that we trick ourselves with so often is we hallucinate this delusional reality where we think the warrior is the fearless one. Mm-hmm. No, I think if someone is fearless, they are not a warrior. At best, they're psychopathic. The warrior is he or she who is afraid at times, mm-hmm. probably oftentimes, because they're in like real situations, but they move their feet anyway. They feel their fear, but they take action anyway. And that action for us sometimes, usually it's not wielding a sword, but I feel afraid about sharing this emotion with my fiance, but I'll be the warrior who has the courage to do it anyway. You know, it's not courage if there's no fear involved. It absolutely isn't.
Right.
And, you know, just, I think it was two nights ago, my fiance right now, she's in Costa Rica doing a teacher training. And so we had a time scheduled to talk, and she was a half hour late. And I was not proud of it, but I felt angry. Like I felt angry that she was late, and she had an understandable excuse. She forgot, like, I get it. Like that's understandable, but I still had this emotional charge where I was angry and I didn't want to tell her about it. I just wanted to be the happy guy who I think is more pleasant for her. But I was fortunate enough to double down on the warrior ethos in that moment and shared with her, you know, I just need to let you know I feel kind of crappy with you being a half hour late. And it doesn't feel good to me. And it was important for me to tell her about my feelings, not deflect from my feelings by accusing her like you did this, Right. No, the true warrior is here's how I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to tell you about you. I'm not going to shame you. That's just deflecting from my feelings and hurting you because I'm hurt. But it's like, no, I got to just tell you about me because this is inside of me. And until I do, it's going to be a barrier. If I never tell you about it, it will always be a barrier. It'll be 3 inches we're further apart. Mm-hmm. And when we do that enough times where here's something I don't want to tell you about me, my feelings, 3 inches times 300 occurrences of that,
yep.
before too long, we're married, but we're living miles apart.
Wow. At what is there any point in which you don't share things that are super small, like little annoyances? The reason I ask is I find myself having these little moments throughout some days where I feel a little bit angry or a little bit irritated, but I tell myself if I let this rest for 5 minutes, I'm going to forget about it. So I'm not going to bring it up. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, I don't have a magic answer yet. I think there's discernment where we need to choose our battles, and not that we're battles is a sort of a bad analogy word here, but yeah, I think the extremes where we're never talking about our feelings, mm-hmm. or the other extreme where we're always talking about our feelings, like, oh yeah, I saw you left a post-it note on the counter and I felt a little irritated about the messiness involved. I just had to get that off my chest. When we're going to that extreme, I think we're actually playing the role of a victim, mm-hmm. where there's just always some kind of pain I got to talk about. Sort of we're becoming a some level of hypochondriac where we always have something that we're victimizing ourselves about. So nobody can tell us like, hey, Michael, hey, JP, like, you know, 6 times a week is the appropriate balance. I think sometimes we cross the line. We can look back and learn from that. Other times we might fall short of the line and we can look back and say, well, maybe I should have talked about that. So But yeah, brother, I think there's times where we just need to discern, is this worth it for me? Will this help me process it? But like you said, you know, I think, you know, when we have those things like in 5 minutes, I'm going to be really over this. Mm-hmm. That probably means we don't need the therapy of sharing it to help us process it.
Well, that answer was a real bummer because I thought you were going to give me like a 10 to 12, like somewhere in there. So
three and a half easy steps to always know everything all the time.
So when you figure it out, just shoot me an email. I'll accept it.
We'll take the mystery out of life so you can always feel in control.
There you go.
I crave that too.
The next chapter I want to talk about in your book is it was something about competitive, this term you called competitive spirituality. And as soon as I started reading it, I started to sting inside because I knew I was going to learn something about myself that I didn't already know. And you had this piece about specifically about meditation, about talking about I meditate versus I meditate for 20 minutes for the last 20 years, right? And like putting numbers to it. And I totally do that. I say like I've meditated for X number of years when that number has nothing to do with what I'm talking about whatsoever. And I do that in a couple areas of my life.
Yeah.
At first glance, that might, you know, most people would think that's not a big deal at all. But what's the risk in that? What's the risk in saying those things just for approval and to impress people?
I think that we risk enslavement to our ego's insatiable need to gratify itself with a sense of significance. So we're risking enslavement to our ego, and that risk becomes greater, and the enslavement becomes more magnetized when we do that crap but don't see it. Mm-hmm. I think it's another thing when we do that crap, but at least we see it. And then it's another thing where we do that crap and then we make a conscious choice to do a little bit less of it. Where, you know, when we talk about meditation, like, man, it's so much less gratifying to tell you, like, Michael, I meditate. But if I, you know, play my trump card, I've been meditating for 10 years, 60 minutes a day, wake up at 4:30 a.m. to do that. You know, I pretend like that's part of the conversation. I don't even know. That's junk food to gratify my ego. I don't know I'm doing that until I realize I'm doing that. And I think earlier in our conversation, you know, I number drop. Yeah, the past 16, 17 years, I've been doing emotional healing coaching. Like looking at that, like I thought, well, that's just what I've been doing. But now looking back at it, as you bring that up, like, yeah, I was probably trying to leverage those numbers for people's minds so they look at me as like a little less significant or a little more significant. That was a little Freudian slip, I think. I think when we notice people doing that, they become less, their attempt to become more significant makes them seem less significant in our eyes. I remember our mutual friend, Joe Polish, and I was not sharing anything that's sensitive information. But my first conversation with him, he's just name dropping people left and right. And it's something Joe does. He is the most connected man in the world. It's amazing. And it helps him express his great gifts. But I didn't know that at the time. So he's just name dropping. And I'm guessing part of Joe, like little ego gratification with his name dropping. So I'm listening to that. And it's like, man, this guy, like I don't know about this guy. He was becoming less and less significant to me. Now I'm glad I didn't just write him off at a quick assumption like this guy is just because he's become a very dear friend and he's just an amazing person. But it is weird when we are through seductive ways trying to become more significant to other people. That's oftentimes when they're seeing us as less significant. Mm-hmm. In my delusional opinion.
I think especially the more the people you're hanging around with, the more self-aware they are, the more they're going to pick up on your attempts to become more significant.
100%. And I think a lot of the listeners, we could relate to just the sleazy, childish immaturity of, you know, you're in a bar and some 19-year-old meathead, hey, how much can you bench, bro? we realize, like, he, and then he, yeah, I'm 345. Yeah, that's what I bench. He is a very wounded child, mm-hmm. just begging for a sense of significance. So we see him doing that, but we have to ask ourselves, what's my version of how much can I bench? What's my version of I can bench this much? Is it stated in spiritual language? Is it stated in business? So yeah, you know, seven figures business last year, and it's like awesome. And please know you're telling me how much you bench.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to tell me how much, if you want to tell me how much you bench, I won't pretend to care. I could care less. But please know you're telling me how much you can bench, so you know yes. you're doing it.
Yeah, that would be a great response to someone telling you how much they make. That's awesome.
But they when they tell us how much they make, they're pretending like they're not telling us how much they're making. They're not saying, yeah, like $1.34 million. It's like, oh, seven figures.
Right.
It's like, yeah, you sleazy asshole. You just, you told me how much you can bench. Come on.
That's great. So I have a couple common things that happen to people that I'm hoping you've heard before. I think people that are listening can probably, a lot of people can relate to one or another of these. So the first is that, let's say someone got divorced. There's someone actually really close to in my life that's gotten divorced in the past year, and it's been incredibly painful, as all divorce is, I'm sure. And he's having a hard time letting go of it. And I'm wondering how he can replace this story in his head, like just let go of the story in his head that this person screwed him over, and start to take some accountability and truly just let go of this emotional charge, as you say.
Yeah, I think unexpressed grief is something that glues us to disempowering stories. And it sounds like his disempowering story is maybe fueled by anger. She did this to me. She screwed me over. And like, maybe she did. But when it's controlling your life, there's something here that's not serving them any longer. So I would guess my experience with people going through divorces is there's the loss of three people they need to grieve. The loss of who they wanted their partner to be to them. Mm-hmm. Like that, you marry someone, you've got, whether you know it or not, you likely have huge expectations of who you want your beloved to be. So he's grieving that loss. He never had her, but he had the expectation of her. So he's got to grieve who he wanted her to be. He's got to grieve who he wanted to be for her. Like, reality has it, he's basically insignificant to her now. Mm-hmm. He probably had a, like, whoever he wanted to be for her, he's got to grieve that. And of course, the obvious is grieve the loss of her as she is. That's probably the easy part. But the hidden grief is the hardest to grieve. So I would invite him, anyone in his situation, grieve who you wanted her to be. She's proven to be someone very different. Mm-hmm. Grieve who you wanted to be for her. When we can't grieve, we will typically stay stuck in anger, because that's where we're at. We you know, that's as close to our heart as we can get. It's probably not very close, but if it's the closest we can get, we'll be stuck there until we break through to the next layer.
So the problem is that it's, the focus is entirely on grieving them as they are.
I think that's the problem. That is one of the dimensions of grief, but it's the most obvious. And yeah, it can be a lot, but because it's the most obvious, it can also help keep us blind to the less obvious, right, to other people to grieve.
Yeah, it seems to keep people from being, so the grieving the person that you wanted to be for them, that seems to be the where you can kind of take some accountability for your part in the relationship, right?
100%.
And without that, then it's all their fault.
And 100%. And when it's all their fault, of course, guess who we're giving our power away to? Mm-hmm. It's your fault. Translate that. It just means you have power over me.
Yep.
And I'm giving you power over me because I'm the one assigning it's your fault. But when we go into radical self-responsibility, we get our power back. And that's not to say, like, if someone treated you like shit, like, learn from it, mm-hmm. you know, have healthy boundaries. But the self-responsibility, the that's my power, let me take it back, that comes through, you know, where is my grief here? I got to grieve who I wanted to be. Like so many of us really beat the hell out of ourselves. Whether we lose someone through death or divorce, we beat the hell out of ourselves because we were never able to be who we thought we needed to be for that person.
Wow.
And it is especially true for people who get their needs met as a rescuer. I mean, that's kind of me, where always looking for someone to save, and what probably started that in our childhood. So yeah, who we wanted to be for the other person was some variation probably of the knight in shiny armor to make them happy and whole forever. It's mission impossible, but
yeah,
tried to do it anyway.
So the second one is, let's say someone's life is going really well. Everything externally looks, you know, nearly perfect. They've got a good job and in relationships, and everything looks like it's going well. But inside, they're feeling apathetic, bored, just not inspired in general, and they don't know what to do about it. What can they do to, like, really reinvigorate their lives?
Man, I think it there's a risk they need to take. And it's not just necessarily any risk, like go skydiving, but maybe that's a good place to, like, just get some momentum. But when we are bored, when we're unfulfilled inside, I don't think that means the purpose of our life is over. Like, yeah, just mastered life. It's pretty easy now. Mm-hmm. I think we get bored. That's the sensation of not being true to what wants to live through us. When we're kind of being true and letting our purpose come through us, that's exciting. It's scary. Like we talked about earlier, it's anything but bored. So I think when we're feeling stuck, unfulfilled in a place of boredom, it's because we're not listening to the call of our true North Star. And it can be a challenging call to figure out. It doesn't come through English. It usually comes through, like, being a banker, like, it's like de-energizing me. So that might mean we have to take a risk of trying something else. And it's called a risk for a reason. We're not guaranteed that the next thing we try will be fulfilling, mm-hmm. but it will be a step away from the wrong direction. But I think once we start taking risks, even if we don't land in the sweet spot of, like, yeah, man, now I'm living completely on purpose, the boredom will probably start to lessen. Some degree of fulfillment will start to be there because we're taking an act mm-hmm. in service of ourself and honoring ourself.
And there's a freedom in that, and like a release of energy, right? Just like coming up to fear, moving through it, even if it ends up being, like, quote unquote, the wrong thing for you.
Yeah.
There's a release of energy, and it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's like maybe it's the wrong thing, but it's a right step.
Yep. And that's the only way to figure out what the right thing is to try different things.
And I don't know of anybody who's been born with a slimy afterbirth covered, like, roadmap of their life uh-huh. just printed on paper. Like, man, the living a meaningful life means we're navigating a dark forest a lot of the time. One of my favorite authors, a guy named James Hollis, he has a saying. He's a Jungian psychologist, and I say that just egotistical, like, validate, like, JP knows, like, sophisticated author, full of crap. But he has a saying that says the living a fulfilling, meaningful life is always proportional to your willingness to tolerate mystery. And if we flip that, an empty, unfulfilling life is going to be proportional to our being stuck in a comfort zone of predictability and familiarity. So meaning and fulfillment, it doesn't come from playing it safe. It comes, according to James Hollis, I happen to agree, it comes from our willingness to tolerate mystery. And tolerate mystery sounds easy on paper, but what that really means is we get scared to death. We take risk where, oh my God, I might get rejected. This might be terrible. But we have to take risk. We have to be willing to be afraid, walking in the mysterious dark forest of our life. Otherwise, we're sitting on the edge of the dark forest of our life, not living our life. And when we're not living our life starts to feel very purposeless for good reason, because I don't think the purpose of our life is to not live our life. I think the purpose of our life is to be the warrior who goes into the dark forest. We know we're going to get scraped up. We know mm-hmm. we'll break a bone. There's going to be beautiful parts too, for sure. And there's going to be dragons.
Right. Oh, I love that quote. That's awesome. So it's a good segue into this. So your videos are absolutely hilarious. And that's why it just makes people stop and watch them, other than your gorgeous red mane, of course.
Yeah. I benched 225 nice. To answer your question. Nice.
So I heard your interview with Aubrey Marcus, and you had a quote in there that said something like, when we are laughing, it's that we're giving ourselves permission to be confused. What do you mean by that?
I think confusion is a powerful step of growth. It means we're leaving what we once believed to be true, and we're searching for another truth. We're taking a step in the direction of our true North Star. But the space in between the old belief, what was true, and my new truth, that space in between is confusion. That's the mysterious dark forest. It's dark. It's a dark forest for a reason. And the metaphor, it's because we can't see. It's not known. It's confusion. Confusion is typically associated as being uncomfortable. Therefore, our survival self-preservation reflex says, oh, it's uncomfortable, it's bad. Don't get confused. Mm-hmm. But I think laughter has a very therapeutic healing property, growth property to it, where we can take an existing belief, and if you or I can make a joke out of it, We poke holes in that belief. We help someone leave the gravity of certainty around a belief or a point of view, and we infuse it with the levity of confusion so that person can divorce themselves from this is me and my belief were one right. thing. Except, you know, laughter is there's space now between me and that old belief, and I can go to a new one now. And I think that's very important. I think laughter is very powerful to help us get confused therapeutically. And I think I always love to challenge people. You are doing good. You are a good court gesture to yourself when you can amuse yourself, or even better, make yourself laugh about what you take most seriously. Is that religion? Is it nutrition dogma? Mm-hmm. Is it your relationship? Like we all have like an electric fence around what we take most seriously, what's most important to it. You know, my kids? No, I don't. I can't laugh about my kids. Oh, gun control? No, we're not going to laugh about that. So we all have those things that are off limits. We have our psychological electric fence around and we say, don't go there. JP's here to say, go there. Amuse yourself. If you can laugh about it, you'll get confused about it instead of certain about it. And if you get confused about it, you're growing.
Badass.
And instead of being limited, keeping yourself so small that you can always fit inside your little stupid electric fence area.
Yeah, you're I have easily my disturbed stupid. in that scenario.
100%.
So you've gained a huge following on YouTube now, and you're getting a ton of positive attention. How do you let yourself enjoy your success while preventing it from getting to your head too much?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think letting it get to my head too much is the magic part. Like, is there ego gratification? Like, yeah, sometimes for sure. But I think What's very important to me is to remind myself often of what matters most. And what matters most is being true to my creative muse and helping people live more meaningful lives. Mm-hmm. What matters most isn't gratifying myself. Now, that's nice. It happens along the way. But it's important for me to make my decisions out of a sense of like this is what the creative muse is asking here, not here's what I think is going to get a lot of views, and also out of like, is this genuinely helping people? Mm-hmm. Is this also true to my heart versus is this going to be clickbait? So often I need to recalibrate with those questions.
What's your relationship to ambition, and do you have any boundaries in your life that between like drive to achieve things and other things that are important to you in your life?
I don't have much balance, to be honest with you. I'm working on it though. You know, my relationship with my fiance Amber, it is a priority for me. And I'm learning how to better treat it like a priority. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the lessons come painfully where, you know, she gives me a talking to, and rightfully so, about JP, you've sun up to sun down. You've been go, go, go. No time for us. And I'm like, damn, you're right. And that feels empty to me too. Mm-hmm. Like, but thank you for helping me calibrate. And by the way, she's got a lot of ambition too. Sometimes I have to give her the talking to. But yeah, you know, two or three weeks ago, I made myself sick for the first time since I was 19. And I had to cancel a business trip. And that getting sick definitely came with a lesson where it was, JP, your ambition, like, you're not short of that. You don't have to prove to the world that you can work hard and be ambitious. I already did that. The power of ambition, you need to pull that back a little bit. We need a little bit more sensitivity here. So it's kind of like the yin yang passion and compassion. I needed to pull the passion back because it was literally burning me out. I was on fire. Right. Too much of an amazing thing becomes a crappy thing. So, you know, I'm constantly in process, and though I had this powerful lesson, I'm not going to pretend like, yeah, Michael, I learned my lesson. It's like, no, I learned something. There's much more to the lesson before right. It's complete.
I love that. Yeah. It's a constant. I don't think you can ever find a constant balance of any area of your life. It's kind of like a wave, right? We're constantly trying to rebalance some area. One thing gets in balance and another gets out, and we have to rebalance over and over and over.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just like the surfer on a big wave, mm-hmm. they don't just be balanced. They're always balancing, center of gravity shifting to the right, center shifting to the left, backward, forward. And it's balancing is a very present moment, ongoing act.
So I've got a few rapid fire questions for you and we'll wrap it up.
What
book have you given as a gift most often?
I think Conversations with God, book one by Neil Donald Walsh. It sounds like a pretty dogmatic book, but it's a very undogmatic, super open-minded philosophical book. I love it.
Sweet. What's a belief that you hold that if others held would have the biggest effect on their life or performance in general?
And yeah, how should I say this? Listening to what's inside of you is the most profitable thing you could ever do. Having the sensitivity, having the awareness to listen, and then the courage to act on that. Most profitable thing we can ever do, profitable in terms of inner fulfillment and outer achievement as well.
So the next question is, what action would you take would you recommend everyone take immediately? You might have just answered it.
Yeah. So predicated on the first question, action on that is any action is the first action. Like inaction is the enemy here. Mm-hmm. But taking first action, whether that's, I'll make a phone call because I had this like faint whisper of an idea. It's probably a stupid idea, but it's faint whisper of it. So do I make a phone call to take the first step of putting that into action? Was it, this video idea? So sometimes I'm writing one word down on my phone notes as a way of taking action on this idea. It's not presenting itself as an amazing idea, but I got to take action on it, or else, you know, the flowering, the blossoming flower will never be fully blossomed unless it takes its first micro action of blossoming.
What a guru thing to say to end this show.
Felt like a flower analogy. Great. Crushed it. I've been doing flower analogies for 35 years. I can bench press 225 and meditate harder than you.
Man, I just want to say, first off, thank you for your time. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing. It's a way to let people feel a little bit more lighthearted about their lives, about the things that trouble them, so that they can really level up in a lot of different ways. And I really appreciate how hard you're working to do that.
Thank you, brother. Michael, I appreciate you, brother. And thank you for seeing that in me.
Where can people find all of your work, find out where you're speaking and all of that type of thing? Sure.
Yeah, my website, awakenwithjp.com. I've got the list of upcoming comedy shows and events I'm speaking at there. And all my social media handles are awakenwithjp.
What do you think would be the best first video for CrossFitters to watch that haven't watched any of your videos yet?
I have to give you two. The first one would be How to Get Offended.
Okay.
Then the second one would be my video on functional fitness.
Hell yeah. I think I've seen that one already. Love it, man. Thanks again for your time, brother.
Michael, you're a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you, my friend.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.